right. Welcome this Thursday, the 25th of July at 7 o'clock in the morning to a live burning platform. Me and Pumi Mashiko standing by to keep you hopefully informed and a little bit entertained. I mean, who is not going to admit at this point that the world we live in is not also the most entertaining place as well as the most bizarre place that we've ever been able to explain? Certainly in news terms, certainly in terms of politics, and the Burning Platform really is about precisely this, is about letting you know what's been going on, mostly in South Africa, but also in the rest of the world. I mean, last week we had a very strong American focus, but we're back in the South today, and we're going to be talking to someone who I think is extremely well positioned to help us figure out what is going on. That person is none other than Mandy Wiener, best-selling author, award-winning journalist, and host of the Midday Report on 702. Pumi, how are you before we get to Mandy?
Hello, babies. Listen. What unprecedented thing is happening this week? This is what I feel like every week. Oh, I told you guys last week, every week now. I just want to remind everyone who's not on my social media, that when we saw Cat Williams, that crazy interview, Cat Williams, that was January. That was January, in case you're feeling like that's so long ago.
And worse, everything he talked about has pretty much come to pass. He's like
he opened a portal.
Yeah, modern-day Nostradamus. And it gets weirder and weirder. Douglas Murray, who we spent a lot of time with, you and I, back in March of this year, I saw him sitting next to Elon Musk in Congress yesterday listening to Benjamin Netanyahu. How's that?
Talk about degrees of separation, quoting Churchill. Like, I'm just saying.
May you live in interesting times is definitely what's going down today. So let's bring Mandy on without further ado, because I am excited to see her and to talk to her again. Mandy has written so many brilliant books, and she is so damn good at what she does. She's almost single-handedly holding up journalism these days. So Mandy, it's great to see you. Oh, come on. You're doing a damn fine job there. Take the compliment and don't worry about the rest of the journalists. Some of them don't need
to. I love your neon sign.
Thank you. I love my neon sign too. It gets a lot of love. Morning for me. Morning, Gareth.
How are you?
I'm well. I've been very busy. There's a lot going on in this country at the moment. So I have been very, very busy. Before I get accused of single-handedly holding up the media fraternity, there's lots of very good journalists doing lots of very good work, Gareth.
Yes, and there are also some particularly bad ones who've done because I'm not a journalist, but the career of journalism, a lot of damage. I mean, IOL this week, we'll get to in a moment or two, and last week and the week before and pretty much all the way back. But let's get cracking. I mean, there are so many things on the agenda for this morning, so many things that I think are valid and that people want to know about. But let's just talk a little bit about investigative journalism, because it is fertile ground out there. Don't think that just because there's a government of national unity now and that everybody is moving in a new direction, that there's a renewed sense of kind of purpose in this country, that everything's hunky-dory, right?
So I think it's really important that we remind ourselves that because we have a government of national unity now, which consists of 10 political parties in government, it means our opposition is weakened. So effectively, it falls to the MK party and EFF to be the opposition. If you think about the fact that the official leader of the opposition, which is an official position in parliament, is an impeached judge, then you have to really think about
Don't call him judge.
So he's a former judge. You don't call him judge. You call him doctor, right? Yes, doctor. So it means that we have to make sure that our other institutions that hold democracy to account are strengthened. So the media, Chapter 9 institutions, the judiciary, civil society, because we are have a compromised opposition in many ways. So it means that journalists are way more important, and civil society and all of those other institutions as well.
Mandy, this is such a place to start this conversation, because Currently, speaking of that, the official opposition looks the way that it does, and the fact that the other institutions that hold various individuals accountable, particularly media, is going to have to play such a much stronger, bigger role. But we have in the past 5 years seen our media treat the president in particular with kid gloves. I mean, the man doesn't answer questions. He doesn't like, and he's been allowed to, you know, he really has been allowed to maneuver, and he is much liked by many people in the media.
Yes and no. So there's been lots of complaints from myself included about the fact that he doesn't answer questions after every address to the nation. He should be having a press conference. Like, why is that not happening? And through SANEF, there have been complaints about that, the fact that he should be more accessible. When he was on the campaign trail, he was very accessible. He was all over the place doing interviews. And I do think that he needs to have open press conferences. I think that that is crucial. I think it's ludicrous that that doesn't happen. And when it comes to kid gloves, you know, I would argue against that. I think that maybe certain quarters of the media favor him more. You think about Pala Pala as an example, and that's something that the media covered extensively. And I think that he wasn't given a free ride on Pala Pala when it comes to the media. So I understand why there's criticism of the media. I think that there was Ramaphosa and the New Dawn. I mean, remember, Ramaphosa was like running on the promenade in Cape Town and everyone was taking selfies with him, right? And then we all realized things were happening way too slowly. But I think that he got very heavily criticized from people who supported him towards the end of the sixth administration, when there was very slow reform and the economy was so stagnant, and growth and unemployment and debt. So I would argue against that a little bit.
I mean, it's interesting, like in the international context, what Pumi's saying isn't so out of place. And, you know, there's nothing sacred. So I hope that you weren't especially and personally upset by the fact that I dragged the media into a zone of questionability. But I do think that there are many institutions that have let us down in South Africa over the last couple of years. And there are certainly individuals in the profession of journalism, just as there have been individuals in many other professions who've let us down. In big business, there are people who've let us down. There are people who've misled us in a number of ways. And I think people are just extremely careful about who they trust these days. Now, it wasn't too much to say that you are one of those trusted voices. What do we make of the fact that people are suspicious of big media institutions in a way that they weren't before? If I think about my parents and generations before them, they just accepted what was on the news. And these days, maybe because of the proliferation of social media and mis- and disinformation, if you're to believe the powers that be, conspiracy theories, all kinds of things that have happened, people are super, super skeptical and cynical about who is delivering the information rather than what the information is. And it used to be the case, and you're the best person to talk to about this, that the journalists didn't make themselves part of the story, and they certainly weren't activists for a cause when reporting a story. But that's also changed, right?
Yeah, look, I think that you have to be very selective and very discerning about who you trust in the media. I mean, when you have people writing about decuplets that don't exist, then, you know, that's a real blight. I mean, they had a birthday recently. No one's ever seen them. So I think that obviously is concerning, right? But at the same time, you also have very credible media. I mean, we only know about VBS and what happened because of Paulie. We only know about Babita Deokaran because of Jeff Wicks. So all of that, I think, needs to be balanced. But look, I don't get everything right. I make mistakes. So, you know, it's everyone's human. I know that there's, you know, a lot of people expect me to get everything right, and there's a lot of pressure to do that. But I do think that the media makes mistakes as well. And we've had to really introspect locally as the media. After we did see what happened during the state capture era with the Sunday Times and the so-called rogue unit, and there really were a lot of issues in the media in South Africa. So I think it needs to be balanced as well. The fact that we have incredible investigative journalism, we have free media, but at the same time, we've also done things that we should not necessarily be proud of, and that means we need to keep ourselves in check as well.
Right. You know, at the risk of making you the spokesperson for all media.
I'm not the leader of SANEF. There's a new leader of SANEF. Get her on.
But I just think one of the things that when I was getting ready for today's show that I thought might be interesting, and you could talk us through some of this because of how long you've been in the role, how long you've been an investigative journalist, and how much trust you have, is just also taking us a little bit through the process of deciding when in the newsroom a story hits. And you know, you say like VBS, for instance, the 2 weeks ago or whenever it was, I don't even remember the timelines anymore because there's so much happening. When that affidavit hit and was available, 260 pages and tons of names in that affidavit. And then we spend a week essentially kind of just tearing apart three people's names that were in the affidavit. How does that happen? How do you decide in a newsroom what you put up and what you kind of forget about at the beginning or forever, as it were?
As the defender of the institution of journalism in South Africa, So look, I do think a lot of this comes down to editorial discretion. It comes down to news sense. So that requires very strong leadership. And that means you need to have very strong editors in place to decide what kind of resources you allocate. The reality of what we're facing in South Africa is that we have shrinking newsrooms. We've seen Media 24 announcing the fact that they are closing down a number of their newspapers. So that means juniorization of newsrooms. It means that reporters are really, really stretched. So you have reporters going to a political press conference one day and a crime scene the next day and then having to analyze an affidavit the next day. So we don't have a lot of institutional memory. A lot of journalists go and become spokespeople for government departments or go into the private sector, right? And that's the reality. So when you have to allocate resources to a story like that, you have to be quite discretionary. And it does come down to a very subjective news sense. What are my listeners interested in? What are my readers interested in? And we have this big debate in the newsroom always around public interest versus what's interesting to the public. So we know that things are important to the public, but they are way more interested in puppy dogs and in like celebrity gossip, right? And Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce or like whatever it is. So we need to explain to people why they should care about things. So when you look at VBS, it is about making it interesting to the public as well, which is why you tend to see a focus on the more high profile individuals and the political parties, because they have a real impact on the lives of many, many people. So that's the way the news cycle effectively works. Gareth, on your point about trust earlier. So I don't know if you've ever read the Edelman Trust Barometer. I mean, it's really interesting because it tells us, it comes out every year, it tells us who people trust. And what it tells us in South Africa is that people don't trust the media. And they don't trust government, obviously. But they do trust business and they trust civil society. So in fact, in South Africa, it's the largest disparity in trust between business and government. So it does show that the media is not trusted. So we also have to be quite careful about what we are reporting and what we are putting out there and earning the trust of the public as well.
Look, so where do you get the stories? Who gives you the intel? Like, who told you there was going to be a raid at Sun City yesterday and then the cameras are there?
I don't know who gave the report other reporters that specific tip off, but I can tell you from experience, right? So some of it does come from official sources. So some of it does come from spokespeople that, you know, if they're going into Sun City with cameras, they would need approval from correctional services. So I imagine that that would have come through official channels. Who tells us, like, gives us tip-offs? It comes from sources, right? And that is developed over a long period of time, cultivating sources, earning trust, earning a reputation, knowing that people can come to you. Often, you know, if something's breaking, it will come from eyewitnesses. So because of social media, it makes it so much easier now. People can just DM you and tell you what's happening. It could come from paramedics. Often a lot of the court stories come from lawyers themselves because it's in their interest. The politics stuff comes from politicians, and you always have to be quite careful about what you believe. So a lot of it's about reputation, right? And about earning a reputation for a particular story.
Speaking of the social media, I mean, on Sunday morning, you tweeted, and I saw this very, very early, you tweeted that somebody was shot, but you can't say anything. And I was like, within minutes, in the thread, people were saying, this is who was shot. It's official here in the South. This is, that was a fascinating thing to watch develop as well. And I wondered, so when you get that DM or that SMS, how you decide, I'm not going to say anything right now. Tell us a little bit about that.
I think I view this very differently now to what I did when I was younger, when I was a field reporter and I was running around trying to break news all the time, and all that mattered to me was breaking news, and I'd be the first person on the scene. So 10, 15 years ago, I would have been on the scene of that shooting on the Saturday night, and I would have been able to confirm personally and see for myself what had happened. I was away for the weekend. I woke up on Sunday morning and I looked at my phone, and I was in the bush and I had terrible signal, and I wasn't about to what you have to remember also is that there's a family out there. This person that was killed has a family. The person who killed him has a family. In the past, I'd be much quicker to just put the name out there. I knew who it was. Everybody knew who it was on social media, but you know, I have to also make sure that I get it right. And listen, we have learned our lesson, particularly on social media, about getting it right versus being first. And you know, we've literally killed presidents. So that went there. So we have to be quite careful. Like, there's always been this big rush to get it first. And I've learned over time that actually it's better to get it right.
I do want to move on to this IOL thing, because again, I'm not expecting you to know the answers, but this is the most bizarre thing I've seen in a long time. I mean, those two people in that video that looked like, you know, cartoon villains, trying to defend themselves against the indefensible of, like, essentially outing someone who was not guilty of anything. Ascribing the incorrect online personality to three different people in the course of a week and trying to ruin, and in some ways succeeding in ruining, their reputations.
Putting their lives in danger.
You know, we often think, and again, I don't want you to assume the role of defending the media in this, but we often think, oh, you know, it's these intrepid, powerless journalists who are up against the machinery of the state, and these are the fourth estate people who are coming to our defense, and they're there to represent the people and all that stuff. But there are also instances where journalists are extraordinarily powerful with very little to back them up, and they can do enormous damage. Now, I think IOL is largely a discredited organization, pretty much in the eyes of everyone except complete morons. But just for the sake of clarity, let's just go over how badly this went for them, because I think it's an instructive use case scenario for people who like to be informed, who like to know what's going on, people who might have once trusted independent newspapers, people who still wish to know who to trust, and people who've just completely given up. I mean, there's some lessons in this, right?
So look, I think that's this entire issue makes me quite sad, actually, because there was a time, and independent media has got a long, rich history in this country. If you look at the Star, you look at the Argus, you know, it really is an institution that has been at the forefront of the vanguard of journalism in this country. So the fact that it's now being abused for personal gain does make me sad, because we've lost that very important resource, but also it's being abused. And I think that is extremely concerning, because what they're doing is not journalism. I think it's a personal vendetta. What we've also been seeing from Iqbal and the independent media is a real onslaught against credible journalists. So there's been this real attempt to identify and just to discredit journalists who are at News 24, at Daily Maverick, and that does not do our cause any good. And the problem is, I know that we in the media follow this quite closely, and we know what is being done, and you and I know the story about the attempt to try and identify, Ghulam. But I'm not sure that all the readers necessarily know and are aware of it. So they still read the newspaper. They still consume IOL because historically it's got that reputation. And that worries me because of the disinformation and the misinformation. And I think that as the media, and again, not to be the spokesperson for the media, but I do think that we've got a collective responsibility to ensure that platform is not abused in the way that it is, and that it's not seen as credible in any way.
Yeah, but I don't know if you can do that at all, and I think maybe, Mandy, for the benefit of our listener, just to cast back a little bit, because I don't think that people have known what has been happening at IOL from when Dr. Iqbal Soure bought the newspaper and bought the brands and all those assets, and how over the past, literally, this isn't something that's Ghulam and these particular individuals, but this is something that over the past almost 15 years has been building up to this place. If maybe you want to talk a little bit about how this story has evolved, how IOL has gotten to the place that it is, and the role played by the owner now of that institution.
Well, look, I mean, I haven't been intrinsically involved in it. I've been busy focusing my attention on things that actually, are not Iqbal Soure. But what we've really seen is him, taking ownership of these newspapers, which are very established, have had a very historically big footprint. If you look at the publication figures now, that footprint is tiny in comparison. And it really has been for his own personal gain and because of his reputation that he wanted to protect. So he very much procured these newspapers as a PR exercise. And this reminds me a lot of what we saw with ANN7 and with the New Age. Yeah. So this is not new to South Africa. We saw the Guptas setting up their own media institutions through these channels. And you speak to anybody who worked at ANN7 and what went on there at the time. So this is something that has repeatedly occurred, and it's something we need to be very mindful of as the media. And as SANEF, that's something obviously that is closely monitored as well, although I'm not a representative of SANEF today. They should have joined me this morning. But again, the fact that as far as I understand, RL doesn't subscribe to the press code makes it very difficult to monitor that as a journalism fraternity. Mm. And we do have measures in place. I mean, we've got the BCCSA, we've got the press code, but if people are not choosing to subscribe to that, then there's very little that can be done. Of course, we do have the laws of the country, which can be used. So now we can see a defamation case and the laws protecting individuals when they are exposed in this way.
So what stories are you following at the moment?
So I've been very busy with the GNU and the political situation in South Africa. We now have a beautiful rainbow GNU. So obviously, because of the election season, and you know, the fact that I do a daily radio show which covers a lot of this, so I've been pretty much consumed with what's been happening with political developments. But I watch everything. You know, I don't do as much investigative journalism in that sense, or reporting in the field. I've done my fair share of that over my career. So now I focus a bit more on speaking to the newsmakers and trying to understand what is happening out there.
And all right, what do just because on the GNU, and I saw you speaking at a conference not so long ago, just talking about why we should be hopeful. Why is it that you are hopeful and think that something different is going to happen in the 7th Parliament?
So look, I'm not Pollyanna by any means. You know, I've spent 20 years on the coalface. So like, literally my job every day is to tell people how bad everything is. Like, I report on crime and corruption and malfeasance and wrongdoing. So I'm not Pollyanna about the situation. But I do try and be quite balanced. I'm maybe a little bit more optimistic about current affairs than you are, Gareth. But the reason that I am cautiously optimistic about the government of national unity is that, look, firstly, it was certainly better than the inertia that we were confronted with over the last administration. And the fact that administration was really struggling to grow the economy, and that, you know, we've seen the decline in infrastructure, service delivery, the quality of life, huge unemployment in South Africa. And I think that by bringing multiple parties together, it does firstly create hope for South Africans. We've seen the markets rally. I know there's been a big narrative around the markets and whether that's a proxy conversation for race in South Africa. But the reality of economics 101 is that we need to boost investor confidence, and we need money flowing into the country, because that does get the economy moving and it creates jobs. And we've seen the markets rally. But also, I do think that what we're seeing now is competition by different ministers. So you've had these new ministers come in with all the gusto and energy and getting stuff done. At Home Affairs, we've seen Leon Schreiber moving very quickly. We've seen Gates and McKenzie. I mean, South Africa's alive with possibility, hey, where you have a convicted bank robber who's now the Minister of Sports, Arts and Culture, and a former military dictator as the Deputy Minister of Defense. But these guys are working all of a sudden. So the incumbent ministers have also have to up their game. And I think that it's also going to force the ANC to re-look or just to hold back on its policy of cadre deployment. I think there's going to be problems. I think it's inherent that there are going to be stumbling blocks. You know, we can speak more about that and the statement of intent and sufficient consensus and all of that stuff. But ultimately, I do think that it holds potential. And I think that there could be real progress.
Well, I mean, you would be surprised to know this, but I don't think the audience would, that pretty much everything you've just said now since Pumi's question is verbatim what I've been saying too. So I am optimistic, funnily enough, and for all the same reasons that you've just laid out so well in that answer. I do think, though, that we've got to be watching very carefully what happens, because this does kind of, you know, Cyril has allowed himself to have an extra a layer of insulation now. Of course, the criticisms that might have come from all those parties that are now in the GNU might not come as hard and as fast as they used to. And, you know, they might not be as lettered and as thoughtful as the criticisms which come from MK and the EFF. And let's just talk about the influence of those two parties, because they're definitely waning in importance. And because they're not included in the tent and they have to be outside of it making noise, they have been given a little bit of attention, but by no means the kind of attention that they've been given over the past, certainly the EFF, the past 10 years. I think MK have done a lot of this damage to themselves. But is there a danger in us paying too much attention to those two parties because they're noisy and because they say outrageous things and they have known crooks in their ranks? Or is there a greater danger in us being rose-tinted when we look at the GNU, just because there isn't as much noise?
Yeah, look, I think the Progressive Caucus, as they are now known in Parliament, are going to get a lot of attention because how vocal they are. And the reality is that they are the official opposition, MK. So, like, they just to read what they said, right? So they said that there was the president yesterday responded saying name calling, race baiting, ethnic chauvinism. You know, he's really come back hard, and in a way, it makes it a bit easier for Ramaphosa to actually take the high ground here. And he comes across as very much having his Mandela moment here because he's bringing the country together, and the Progressive Caucus is coming across as much more divisive, much more angry. There is a lot of race baiting. There is a lot of criticism, and I do think it's going to get uglier. However, the EFF has said that they want to kind of be a bit more grown up this time around, and I think that what we've seen so far from Julius Malema before VBS and the affidavit. So when we had the first sitting of Parliament, when Ramaphosa was elected, I was actually quite impressed with Malema and with Ndlozi and how they approached their role as the opposition. I think that they actually have come into it with a lot of research. They really understand the rules of Parliament. They understand the role that they have to play. And I think that boded quite well. I think MK, on the other hand, could just be chaos because they haven't got that institutional understanding. And I think there are a lot of MPs there who are going to perhaps abuse the process. So that does worry me. But I think it also creates the opportunity for Ramaphosa to really appear better than what he may be.
Yeah. And Mandy, speaking of Julius, I mean, I do think that his remarks in the plenary when on the budget vote, the presidency's budget, were quite sharp, well thought through. He was scathing of the president, and he was very grown up is the word that they've said and that you've used, but he really was on the ball when it came to that. But I think that no one is really listening to him anymore because he's made so much noise for so long that these things get lost. I thought it was actually quite spectacular.
Yeah, look, I think the thing about the EFF that people often forget is that they really prioritize education, tertiary education. Like, give them credit where, you know, from doctorates to master's degrees, they have spent the time working on that. And I do think they really understand the rules of Parliament and how Parliament works. I think that what got a lot of the focus, though, was the personal criticism of Ramaphosa. And that really pissed him off, I think. He came out quite strongly about his father and what was said about him and this, you know.
2 years ago.
Yeah. So I think that what we're going to see from the EFF is, you know, more thought through, more considered. But, I mean, the EFF, as you say, are largely discredited. I mean, they have a history of being, you know, of leaning towards violence and disruption, of really, you know, not answering fully to the VBS claims, but that needs to be answered to in a court of law. So the fact that you had Julius Malema storming the stage at a SONA and literally compromising the security of a president, but just that display in itself. Look, I think some people might like that, but I don't think it gives him credibility in an institution like Parliament. So I think that they've been quite cognizant about the fact that they need to change that approach. And because the DA and the IFP and the PAC and the UDM aren't there, then, you know, they need to play a different role.
Do you think Dr. John Klopp is going to be the most heard member of Parliament? I mean, almost after every single appearance now, you know, we have seen the media shove a mic in his face and listen to what he has to say. I think he's rebranding very well over there.
It's the washing machine of politics in South Africa. Where you actually know, look at Busisiwe Mkhwebane. She's also rebranded. Patricia de Lille, Bantu Holomisa, you know, they've all had various guises over the years. But the fact that John Klope is the official leader of the opposition, he's going to get airtime. And it's new and novel. So I think that's it. So I do think that he's going to get a lot. But look, I think also what seems to be getting a lot of focus is someone like Songezo Zibi, of Scopa. So I think that it'll take time to kind of, for everyone to take on their new positions. But I would watch the portfolio committees. I think that often, you know, that's where the real work happens. And it's quite exciting to have someone like Songezo at Scopa. So I think that a lot of the important stuff is going to come from there.
Mm. I was quite curious to see people's reaction. And you know, as much as we analyze and perhaps overanalyze the role of the media in society, we've also got to look at people. And the people who are consuming that media stream are sometimes also extremely stupid and are really looking for the dumb story. I mean, you mentioned like soap operas and celebrity gossip, and that is what South Africa likes. We know from ratings that that's what people care about. Very often, people also reach for the lowest hanging fruit rather than having to do the hard work of trying to figure out whether something's true themselves. So they use other people as proxies for them, as filters, as editors, so that they can figure out what's actually going on. In the reaction to the State of the Nation address, which was, I think it's fair to say, muted, I think people generally are going, okay, it appears to me like government are performatively anyway playing the role of serious and well-intentioned and trying to do their damnedest. And as you mentioned, there's going to be competition now within cabinet where they're going to be trying to prove to each other that they're the best for the job. Gives the ANC a bit of a clean slate in some ways, and it gives them someone to blame if things don't work in the form of all the other parties. So it's not just them. And the ANC loves some collective responsibility. But are people in South Africa, it's probably an unfair question to ask you, but we've asked you a lot of unfair questions already. Are people in South Africa too stupid sometimes to actually understand what is going on? Or do you give them credit? Because often I will think, you know what? There's a lot of dumb shit going on here. And there are a lot of very dumb people who don't understand stuff. And even if you tried, most of them would phase out at some point. You know what I'm talking about, Pumi. The minute you get into one of your 300-page reports, people's eyes glaze over. Am I wrong?
Not because they're stupid, but because they don't care. People care. Most people care about their lives. They care about their jobs. They care about their children. They care about, they actually don't give a shit about all of this other stuff. Part of the reason why their eyes glaze over is simply because for them, they cannot see the connection between that thing and their everyday aspiration. And it's the world over. That's how people are. Sure. People don't, these kinds of things kind of just like, whatever. And I see we've lost Mandy, but while Jack tries to get her, I mean, one of the things, Gareth, about not caring about these things is also because there's so much of this stuff. Of the stuff that you have to carry in your head. And there's so much kind of, you have to, a lot of the time, you have to hold two ideas at the same time. And most people just, their brains can't do that, right? Because you do have to, like I say, when I watched Julius's remarks, I really was taken aback at the fact that he was considered, he really thought it through. And in fact, the response of the president to what Julius had to say, for me, showed the president up to be a whining baby, right? He was like, oh, you came up here and you were mean about my dad and me. And I was just like, but you haven't addressed the stuff that he's talking about, But that, the cognitive dissonance of going, this is the same Julius that you have to understand, is the kind of person who unashamedly would accept money from VBS, knowing that this is the hard-earned money of the poorest families in Limpopo, would spend that money on Gucci loafers, right? Yep. You have to hold those two things in your head at the same time. And most people don't want to have to deal with that shit. They just want to raise their kids, take them to school, feed them, watch TV, have sex with their wife.
Well, Azalea is agreeing with you. Pumi is correct about South Africans. We're tired. We're jaded by all the bullshit. And I think we maybe have reached this point, but I want Mandy to have a go at this question too, because we've asked her a lot of tough questions about the media. But do you think that there is an appetite in the public to hear complicated investigative stories that take up page after page after page? Or do you think people just give me the headlines. I'll go on X and I'll find someone's opinion. Just pretend it was mine.
So yes and no. So I think that what we tend to see a lot of, and what I've encountered, is a lot of people have chosen to just like put their head in the ground and not follow the media at all. So what we see a lot of is people saying, "Oh, it's very depressing. I don't listen to the radio anymore.
I love those people. I'm just not interested. Because it's so sad and depressing."
Exactly. It's so sad and depressing. And it's much easier to just listen to, to music, or, I get a lot of that. But I do think that there actually are plenty of people that follow investigative journalism and people that immerse themselves in current affairs. So I think that there's a lot to be said for that kind of investigative journalism that is, 5,000 words and very technical. And you look at state capture, and a lot of the reporting around state capture was following the money. So it was looking at post box accounts and the money flow, and it was very detailed. But that also formed the basis of the State Capture Commission, where they looked at the investigative journalism and that guided them towards what they were supposed to be investigating. So there's value to that, but I'm not sure that people consume that in the way that they necessarily should. I think people are more interested in just getting the top line and getting the X version. People would rather watch 60 seconds of an interview on TikTok and share that. People have very bad social media hygiene in this country. I have a lot of people often saying to me, "I'm not watching the president, I'll read your summary." Literally all the time, I'm not wasting my time with, "Can you just explain it to us?" And that's a large part of the role that I feel that I do play, is making things palatable and explaining to people why they should give a shit. Because it does frustrate me that they don't give a shit necessarily.
Yeah. I think, Carl makes this point in the comments. He says, "I love politics, but I have no friends I can talk to about it. I don't think my wife even knows who the deputy president is. Do I have stupid friends, or am I the exception?"
No, but, Mandy, I also saw that you didn't invite us to the launch of Africa's Great Crime Stories, but I won't hold that against you. But I do want to talk about that, because the other thing that we've become so accustomed to is consuming news in this entertainment form, right? We're so accustomed to consuming a Killing Kibble, which I loved. We're all watching a Chasing Thabo Bester on Showmax, and now your new show. We've become addicted to the condensed version that has all the big things, and it's real life, but it feels like a TV show.
Yeah, it's infotainment. I think that's the word they use. Look, the thing with South Africa is that we have certainly got so much information and so many news stories. Like from Rosemary and Lovu, who literally killed 5 members of her own family to get the insurance payout, to Thabo Bester, who faked his own death. And like, it's wild. You can't make this stuff up. You really can't. So I think that's why South Africans, we always say it's a movie, because it is a movie. Dion Meyer always says that if I had to take the script of one of my books and put it in his book as a novel, no one would believe him. So
Yeah, I think that often truth is stranger than fiction. And that means that as South Africans, we get quite consumed by the soap opera type stories, where we don't always focus on the more detailed, analytical, serious kind of media and investigations. So we do spend a lot of time and energy as the media focused on the Thabo Bester stories, the Senzo story, the more high profile, sensational stories. And because we have a lot of them, we tend to focus. And you spoke earlier about how do we decide what to cover. And I think a lot of it does come down to that. It comes down to what are our audiences interested in. But as the media, we also have a responsibility to explain to people why they should be interested in other things that actually affect their lives. Like the two-pot system, is something that is being introduced. The president has signed into law. People should absolutely give a shit about that, right? But they'll be far more interested in a Thabo Bester. So it is a responsibility for us as the media to also explain to people why they should care.
Yeah, I'm going to just be lazy here because that's what people in your feed obviously do. They expect you to do all the work for them. And I'm going to ask you a tough question about how you choose your news. I mean, like, what is your process on, particularly online, because we all have these tools available to us now. It's not as if, excepting those people, of course, who put their head in the sand, we can't help them, but everybody else has the ability to access more information than they ever could have before. All of those primary sources that hitherto were only the preserve of journalists are now available to everybody. We just have to know how to use them. And you mentioned social media hygiene. And I think that that's something we could all learn from. How do you respond when you see something unbelievable on X, for example, like Donald Trump's been shot, and you're a little dubious about the source? What is the best course of action for you as a trained, experienced journalist who's seen and heard probably the most outrageous things imaginable and then had to make sense of it for the rest of us? How do we get online and make sure that we don't get carried away by bullshit and at the same time know that this is a trustworthy thing, we can actually go with this? How many times do we have to check? Who do we have to check with? What is your best practice?
Listen, I can't tell you how many times I get messages from people. Is this true? And it's so obviously not. And it's always on the family WhatsApp group, where people share things, and your neighborhood group where people just assume it's true. And there's just don't be an idiot, right? There's some stuff that you can check to see if it's legit. The first one is if it comes from a website that is like newsfirst.org.za that you've never heard of before, then chances are it's not true. So firstly, check that it comes from a credible organization. Check the date of the story, because often people will share stuff that is 5 years old and think that it's new and current. And then to see who else is reporting it as well. If Trump has been shot, then is it being reported by several big media outlets? Do they have attribution? Is a huge thing for me. So it's really important to attribute who is saying what, and to pre-attribute. And I think that's something that journalists don't always do. You can't just say what has happened as fact. You can attribute it to who has confirmed it and who is saying it. And that is really, really necessary to make sure that you, as a journalist, attribute that so that you're not necessarily stating it as true. Over the years, I've kind of curated my social media feed. So I know who to follow for what, for different stories. I follow journalists all over the world. I follow journalists that have specific beats. I think my algorithm's a bit stuffed. So I get like so many Travis Kelce videos. I can't even begin to tell you. I don't know why. That I have a serious I have a lot of panel videos. So I do think that you have to be quite careful of your algorithm and what you fed. So I do read very widely, and that's something that is crucial and that a lot of journalists I think don't necessarily do today. is read extensively. So that means not just going to one media outlet for your content. So I read, you know, I read the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Guardian and all of that. But it's also about the other platforms that I don't necessarily agree with. In a post-truth world, we have to make sure that we are as informed as possible so that we can understand the context of something and whether something is legit or not.
Yeah, it's tough. I don't think anybody knows the exact answer to that question, but it does mean that we should all be a little bit more careful and not just careful to believe it ourselves, but especially careful to pass it on. I mean, you mentioned those family groups. I'm so glad that even you fall prey to these things. But everybody has a group where there's some crazy aunt on it who likes to spread malicious bullshit just because it makes her feel important that she's like some kind of breaking news source. we all know that someone has changed their route home because of a photograph that someone else sent them on WhatsApp about, oh, don't use that road. There's a big riot. You drive past there and there's nothing. There's nothing going on. It's
well, my personal favorite is Mandy Wiener said. So not too true. Mandy Wiener said on Facebook there.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose it doesn't matter how many brilliant inputs we have in our lives. It's still like that village idiot who manages to misquote people like you. Mm-hmm. And then that, unbeknownst to you, does you some damage where you weren't even involved. You're like, I didn't talk to anybody. What do you mean you Mandy Wiener said?
You know what's really good is when people tell me what I've told them on the radio. So they'll be like, oh, I heard this interview on the radio where this person said, you know, like X, Y, Z. And I'm like, yes, I did that interview. They did not say that. They said the complete opposite of that. Yeah. So that's my personal favorite.
So, okay, speaking of personal favorites, I'm very interested to know of all the crazy stuff that you come across, all of the things that over the years you've reported on, for you, most bizarre but true story.
Oh, there's been a lot, eh? You're asking me to come up with one. I mean, the Kimmel story in itself was wild. So and that's obviously the one that has been most associated with me because I wrote a book about it. But like the fact that you have self-confessed killers telling the story about how a mining tycoon drove to his death three times and the car broke down and then the gun didn't go off. I mean, that story is just astonishing. So I think that's it. Phone, right? But then when I was reporting on Radovan Krejcer, and I don't know if you remember the story about the Polo that had the guns in the number plates and they were remotely controlled. So the number plate lifted up and the guns fired at him. I mean, that's the stuff out of movies. It's James Bond stuff, man. And it's happening in our backyard. Yeah. Like it happens in Melrose in Bedford View. And the Tabo Bester story is, I don't even know where to start with it. Like it's all the layers. It has all of, you know, it's got the celebrity doctor. It's got the body. It's got you know, the con man from prison. You've got the escape to another country. Like it just has everything. And we so often see like the nexus of politics and business, organized crime, and it is just so ripe for the most unbelievable stories in this country.
We are.
Bitcoin Butch says on this note, my aunt is the admin of the family group on WhatsApp. Bloody dictator, that woman who gets crazy upset once a month. About right.
So, I do want to say, if you don't have a crazy person, if you're not in a group with a crazy person like that, check yourself. You might be the crazy person.
Listen, you're one to talk. Pumi was bringing me inside info the whole way through the elections of this is going on inside that party and that. And she was right on everything. So I don't think she's on crazy groups, but she's got some powerful friends, this Pumi Mashal.
But the groups are crazy.
Listen, these days it's also it's very hard for people to make stuff up, but I think, you know, if there's a willing audience for it, it can go far, even if it's utter nonsense, flat earth type stuff. And there seems to be quite a lot of that going on. I saw just yesterday people were saying, oh, no, no, Joe Biden's definitely dead. They've got body doubles. It's someone else. They've been using puppets.
This is a weekend at Bernie's, like the whole story, yeah, huh?
He's wearing a mask and you could see the lines behind his ears and there's all this stuff going on. I mean, you know, it is so weird that I think it all changed with COVID. I really do. Before then, it was so much easier for people to just go, okay, yeah. I mean, if it's coming from that person or if it's coming from that organization, cool, I'm with it. There could be something like COVID around the corner. I don't know whether people will fall in line like they did before, whether they'll be as ready to change their lives, put everything on hold as they might have before. But the one thing that's perhaps in retrospect been good about that is it has forced people to question things. And that's not a bad thing. You've questioned things your whole life long. What's the next book going to be? Because as you've illustrated in just a few of the answers you've given to us in this discussion, there is so much material in South Africa. You don't have to look far. You have to lift a lot of rocks up. And someone like you has people coming to you with stories all the time. You've probably got like 10 books in the offing, and I'm sure that it's hard work and it's a daunting prospect. But what's most exciting for you next in terms of being able to write? Because we all love your radio stuff. We all love your investigative reporting when you do that. But the books are really the thing that I think has established your reputation above all else.
So the problem I do have is that there is a lot to choose from. And not every story is a book. And I think that we've seen that. I can't say for certain what it is that will be my next book, but I do think there's a lot going on in the country that deserves writing about. You know, I have been bullied quite a bit by some other local fiction writers to try and write fiction. You know, I have thought about that to try and try my hand at writing some fiction, but I honestly think that the nonfiction stuff is so wild that it's almost not necessary to make anything up. But I am due a book. I've been too busy, you know, just with the day-to-day stuff that I haven't got there. So I don't know, but yes, I do need to write something. I'm working on things. The other thing is that everyone thinks that their story should be told in a book. I get lots of requests from people. Will you please write my book? Will you please, you know, this is my life story. And unfortunately, when you look at it with perspective and some of the other things we've seen, it's not really a book or a story. So I do get a lot of those kinds of requests as well. And unfortunately, I just don't have capacity to write all of them. But, you know, you never know what's going to happen in this country. Anything could happen. So, especially with a GNU, a rainbow GNU. So I think that we're set for another 5 years of turbulence and lots of interesting news. So I'm not sure yet.
So just what you're telling us is stand by. Anything could happen.
Stand by. Anything could happen. Listen, the one thing I have learned, Gareth and Pumi, is that I do not make predictions on the radio or on any platforms, because in 2 years' time, you're going to come back and play this to me and be like, well, you were wrong. or what the hell happened to this? So I've learned to not do any crystal ball gazing and predict what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah, I think that's very wise. Listen, it's always nice to spend time with you. And we'll all be following you on various platforms and making sure that we pay attention to you. I think the best place to start that process is on X. You can follow Mandy there. We'll put all tags in the description of this podcast. By the way, if you haven't liked and subscribed yet, then make sure you get on to the podcast party and get in there so that the notifications arrive so you'll know what's happening when Pumi and I are doing these shows, who we'll be talking to. You get the info in advance of everyone else. It's useful to know that stuff, because another thing is, who has the time to pay attention to everything, right? And for all we know, there might be some earthquake in Bangladesh this morning that obviously doesn't affect all of us, but some people can't get enough news. You have to be very careful.
No. They're rioting. The students are rioting in the streets of Bangladesh.
Oh, really? I mean, you could be telling me. It could be happening. I wouldn't know.
Yes, we did.
No. I would trust you, Pumi. If Pumi says something, I believe her. All right. It's thanks, Mandy. Cool, lovely to see you.
It was good to see you, Mandy.
Good chatting. Thank you. As the representative of media in South Africa.
Yeah.
You did a good job. Good job.
You did a very good job of defending the whole media. There she is, none other than best-selling author.
She should write a book about the day couplets. Okay, no.
Who cares about that anymore? Best-selling author, award-winning journalist.
They don't exist.
Host of the Day Report on 702, Mandy Wiener. Lovely to see you. And Pums, we will be back next week with more of The Burning Platform. Make sure you don't miss it. As I said, there are ways that you can subscribe and get the information before everyone else. Use those ways. It'll make
your day. Turn on your notifications.
Spot on. And we will get back into the heart of South African politics from next week on. God knows what else could happen in between. So pay attention.
The times are interesting.
Cheers, everybody. Bye.